KZSU, Stanford University's FM radio station, broadcasting across the Bay Area on 90.1 FM and across the world at kzsu.org. From the campus of Stanford University, this is the Innovators Radio Show and Podcast, featuring in-depth one-on-one interviews with mission-driven entrepreneurs, renowned thought leaders, and game changers committed to ideas, innovation, and getting the heck out of the building. Our radio show and podcast illuminates the struggle, breakthroughs, and exceptional outcomes game changers bring to industries, organizations, and lives. Hosted by Tom DiOro, Principal of Accurate, and retired Colonel Pete Newell, CEO of BMNT.
Thanks, Tom. For our guest today, please welcome Michael Brown. Mike is the director of the Defense Innovation Unit, an organization within the U.S. Department of Defense that fields leading edge commercial capabilities to the military faster and more cost effectively than traditional defense acquisition methods. Mike had a long career in cybersecurity and software, is a former White House Presidential Fellow, and has been a member of the Board of Trustees of the Berklee College of Music in Boston since 2013. He has also previously served on the President's Advisory Council. For more information, you can visit Mike's LinkedIn profile at Michael A. Brown, CEO, or you can visit DIU at diu.mil. Mike, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you.
I stumbled all over myself trying to get through that. I will eventually come back to the Berklee College of Music.
Okay.
But before I do that, because you're a long-time denizen of the Valley, you clearly got your career started, like most people around here, working for somebody else. So from the early days, something humorous to start us off. and then we'll talk about how you survived that and became Michael A. Brown, CEO.
Okay. Well, it's great to be back on the Stanford campus. In fact, I went to business school just right across the way here, back when the business school was across.
Wow.
Across the street.
You just dated yourself.
Yes, I'm that old. And met my wife and my business school class, and we decided to settle here ever since.
Isn't there a rule that says you're not supposed to marry anybody you go to business school with?
There's no rule. In fact, I understand that's about, 10% of the class
does. Was...
So I think there's quite a few folks who find their spouse there. So.
Yeah.
Well, you asked me for something funny. I remember my first job out of business school was with Quantum, one of the leading disk drive manufacturers at the time. In fact, a time when there were over 100 disk drive manufacturers, if you can believe that. That was probably one of the most massively overfunded industries by venture capital in the early 80s. Well, I was a young product manager. I was with my boss, David Brown, who was the president of the company, founder of the company. He was an engineer, knew everything about disk drives, and we were on a trip to visit IBM in Rochester, Minnesota, kind of a mecca if you were in the storage industry. And we got on a plane from San Francisco to make our connection in Chicago to head to Rochester. And as young product manager, of course, couldn't wait to go take care of some voicemail. Yes, that old. There was voicemail, not email, to get done when you landed. So got busy on a payphone to get that done, rushed to get on the plane for the connection. And the stewardess came up to me and said, "Excuse me, are you sure you're on the right plane? You're on the way to Rochester, New York, not Rochester, Minnesota." Of course, I, very embarrassed, picked up my things and went to greet my boss, who was had a Cheshire Cat smile on, and of course never let me live that down, and was continually reminding me to pay attention to the detail. "You're going to get in trouble, Mike, if you don't pay attention to the detail." I've never forgotten.
So do you find yourself looking sideways at the gates now? Like every time you go to a gate, like, stop.
I'm reading that screen a little more carefully these days.
I thought I was the only guy that had ever done that. They literally made it all the way to the plane and sat down.
Pretty embarrassing when you have to sit down to with the president and he summoned you from the wrong plane.
I'm going to say the 2 seconds we look at and say, "Wait a minute, this going someplace better?" I'll stay here. I'm good.
That's right.
And maybe I have a job afterward. So back up prior to business school. Then I'm going to come back to you're director number 3 of DIU. And because I've personally known each of the directors, all of you have been very different. So I'm going to back up into your background a little bit.
Sure.
So you left college and kind of entered this world, but not necessarily headed into site work because it wasn't a big issue back then. So what were you doing that eventually led you to Stanford to get an MBA that launched you into a cyber career?
Well, I'd say...
How'd you get there? I mean, that's the...
I was interested in music, and very early in my career was a question about music versus a business career, and realized after spending hours and hours of practicing a piano, working on concerto competitions, that I was really more of a people person. I didn't really get as excited about spending 8 hours in a practice room. So then that kind of led me to a career focused on business. So I studied economics, was interested in business school because that was the practical application of economics. Lucky to get into Stanford, met my wife in my class here. And then that was the time when tech was really becoming a thing here in the Valley. IBM had just introduced their PC. So this is the early 80s, and an exciting time to join a storage company, a young company that was public, but newly public. So it was a whole new world of what was happening in tech. Still the exciting things that were coming from the revolution in microelectronics.
Yeah. So you're probably the third person I've met had a background in music that switched economics. So, I mean,
For me, without as much talent, it was a good thing to do.
No, well, it's either that or musicians, you know, figure out economics quick when they're not eating.
That too.
But I think it's true that people say that the music is really a mathematically based thing, that if your brain is tuned to understand how tunes come together. My wife is like this, great musician, but she's a business manager. She does finance and would have never thought that that's what she would have done. I'm going to make a leap and say that that same kind of mentality flows well into the cyber world. And kind of do the same thing. But how much do you find yourself kind of digging back to, I don't want to say your roots as a musician, now running companies? Does any of it transfer? I mean, is it, what stuck with you from the early days to now?
Well, I think...
Other than the rigor of
having... Well, the rigor and the discipline is a key part of it. I think you're onto something there. I don't think so much about the experience focused on music as helping me in business, but certainly the what you've done earlier in your career makes an impression. The story I just told about my early mentor, president of Quantum, focusing on the detail is something that certainly stuck with me and something that carries over into everything I've done since then. And then as you start learning about concepts in business school and then get some real world experience, strategy, okay, I have to look at the big picture. Where are we heading here? What's our mission? What are our goals? That certainly carries over into the current work at DIU. So I think the things you learn about business, leadership, what does it take to get results, working with other people, those are universal. And I think carry with you and help you accomplish things, whether you're in a business environment, a government environment, or wherever you are.
Okay. And as a Stanford MBA graduate, the top three things that you took away from your experience as an MBA here that you're still using today, and then some that you think that you probably learned that probably have faded?
I think, as I mentioned, learning about strategic concepts in business is something that you certainly carry away. Getting a foundation for how to think about a company or an organization financially, which is, you know, reading an income statement, a balance sheet, what's cash flow all about, that certainly was with me. One of the most interesting courses, and I hear this from other Stanford Business School graduates that I took, was one that was called Touchy Feely. The official name was Interpersonal Dynamics. It was taught by a professor named Jerry Porras. And it was really... the very practical, it really taught in a seminar fashion where you're sitting down with other groups of 8 to 10 people and just talking about how you relate with one another and very honest conversations about how what you say and how you say it is coming across to the other people in that group. Well, what could be more valuable to a young person than getting that insight into how you're coming across early on to make you more self-aware, to develop that, you know, sense of what then Daniel Goleman went on to write as emotional intelligence, to combine with whatever natural intelligence you're bringing, because that's such an important part of the equation of getting things done in an organization.
And actually, I was going to say that I would not have answered that question that way 10 years ago. But having now taught the Hacking for Defense class here at Stanford, watch the students, I think the concept of learning how to talk to humans and being precise in your language and understanding the meanings and the other things you have with it is probably the hardest thing they grapple with. And I never realized how difficult it was for people to actually do that and then realize that they're not taught. And it's a socialization skill.
Completely.
That permeates virtually everything. So now going back, I could look at problems in so many areas and say, whether it's a workplace dynamic or whether it's a subordinate leader issue, you name it, it comes back to how people use language and how they interact together, particularly if you're trying to learn something from somebody. And it's less about talking out than it is about the words you use to form questions that elicit more information back from somebody. I think that was dead on.
So some of you asked about the things that you forget, some of the specific analyses, conjoint analysis and marketing, or those techniques were interesting to learn, but not using them every day. So there's a lot of the specifics that go away.
Those are like OJT things. You know, the more you do it on the job, the more you learn and the more you think.
Or you realize you don't need them anymore.
So flashing forward to the Defense Innovation Unit, you're director number 3, and you were previously a CEO of a very large company, and other than Presidential Innovation Fellow, but really no previous government,
none,
DOD experience.
None.
So I just screw up and get this job. Yeah. You know, it's like, so and I'm not asking how, but it's really why.
When I was making that transition from Symantec and thinking about what to do next, I was approached by Raj Shah, who was the second director and a terrific guy. We're still friends. Second director of DIU. And he said, when we were talking about what I might be interested in doing next, he said, I've got a question that came from Secretary Ash Carter to understand, what are the Chinese doing with their investments in Silicon Valley? How big are those investments in total? What are they investing in and why? Tell me a little bit about what their thinking is. Raj said, I'm busy running DIU. I don't have the bandwidth to take this on, but it's a very important problem and we should develop some recommendations for Secretary Carter. Well, I thought that was a pretty interesting question to pick up on, and very different from what I had been working on leading a public company. So we're all at different stages in life thinking about what do we want to do next. It's going to be interesting, as opposed to how do I leverage to the highest degree whatever I've done in my last job. And this had a lot of appeal to me intellectually to try and understand this problem. So it was the right question at the right time, produced a report, which I think you've read, Pete, which really talked about the fact that not only were the Chinese making a very aggressive effort in terms of investing in new technology right at the start, so leading edge technology with startups, we're talking artificial intelligence, gaming, cyber, you name it, they're in these different fields. This was a real issue for us because, as you know, our military superiority from at least World War II was based on having technology that our adversary didn't. And the military even had a term for that they call offsets. So when we had nuclear weapons and the Soviets didn't, that was the world of the first offset. Of course, that didn't last very long. It was about 4 years until, through some illicit means, the Soviets got access to nuclear weapons. But of course, we had another period of offset probably in the early 90s, first Gulf War. We had, you know, communications from satellites and laser-guided munitions. Night vision goggles, all the things that allowed us to go into Iraq and defeat the 6th largest army in 6 days with very few casualties. And the world was watching. to see how that technology superiority translated into success on the battlefield. So I think in the minds of the folks at the Pentagon at that time was, what can be the third offset? Well, if you've got your potential adversary at the table learning about technology at the same time you are, China's strategy, there's no way you're going to have an offset, because not only is technology being diffused globally much more quickly than ever before, but in our open society, if you can come and invest and learn about what's happening in these areas right from the start, you're not going to develop any offset. So this was a bit of a startling conclusion as we were still pursuing what could be the third offset. And the question arose, okay, what to do about that? We peeled the onion on that back a little bit further in this paper, which is public and anyone can get access to it, to say, okay, what is China's game here? What are they really trying to do? Well, smartly, as we've seen them, you know, rise economically faster than any country in modern history. They went from 10% of the U.S. GDP to today, probably on the order of 2/3. And that's in dollar terms. If we look at it in purchasing power parity, their economy is already bigger than ours. So that happened so fast. That happened from the time of the 70s, when, you know, we changed our strategy with China in response to, it took the U.S. much, much longer to go from that percentage of the U.K.'s economy to being a challenger for U.K. And of course, that transition happened in the late 19th century. So no one alive even remembers that transition. We've been the largest economy in the world for everyone's lifetime and before that. So now a very fast changing dynamic in terms of China's economic rise. And China realizing that to continue that pace, they need to transform their economy through technology. In other words, enough with producing, you know, low-cost shoes and toys. And it's really all about high technology. It's about how can you produce satellites and supercomputers and chips and you name it. And that's why they were investing in leading-edge technology in the U.S. Not only the U.S., because they were going around the globe to look at where could they get technology. And they have a strategy. We identified 10 different mechanisms that allows them, through the illegal means that we know and talk about, cyber theft, industrial espionage, but in a large part through legal means, to get access to technology. That's by investing in startups, students who are Chinese foreign nationals, studying STEM fields here at Stanford and other leading universities, forming networks of which are ostensibly about networking for people's careers that really are about recruiting talent back to China. The Thousand Talents program that the chemistry chair at Harvard University was just found to be participating in. There's a really long-term, systematic, well-thought-through plan that China has to transfer technology back home to China, with the thinking of they want to be the world's largest economy, they want to be leading in technology, and they want to make that happen, you know, during current leadership's lifetimes. That was an eye-opener for me. It was an eye-opener for some folks in the Defense Department.
My eyes are open now.
Yeah, and there was that eye-opening and saying, we can't be asleep at the switch like we have been with 5G, to realize we have to change some things about how we're operating if we want the U.S. to be the most vibrant economy and technology power for the next 50 years, the way we've been for the last 50. Yeah. That's what kind of made me much more mission focused than I'd probably been in my career.
Well, the idea that yes, there's a third offset and we're not on the winning side of it right now.
I wouldn't go that far.
And just that we might not be on the front side of it, because, and here's, you know, I read the report, and my takeaway was, the Chinese managed to rush away our manufacturing capacity that was a machine in the 60s and 70s and early 80s. It was a juggernaut, and now suddenly it's all in China. And that wasn't enough to put them on the world stage in equality, because we simply shifted to a technology base. So it's not a shocker that they, okay, we need to be that. And then used the very same methodology that they used to move the industry that way, is to go after another one and try and move it the same way.
I think about it this way. We're in a tech race, which I call a marathon, because it's not a short-term race. We're going to be in this for
our spurts and
our lifetime and perhaps longer. And so I think this is a marathon between the superpowers of the U.S. and China. The National Defense Strategy talks about the return of great power competition, which includes Russia. But the truth is, China is really the only power that could really challenge the U.S. on the world stage for the next 25 or 30 years. And it's because of their economic rise, them becoming a larger economy, perhaps, than the U.S. in dollar terms. Most economists think that will happen in the next 10 to 15 years. It's that difference relative to what we faced with any previous challenges, say in the Cold War with the Soviets, that makes this competition very, very different. So I think we're in this tech race, and I think most of the public in the United States doesn't even realize we're in a race. I don't think we're talking about this to the extent we should, because there are some things we need to do differently, like reinvest in science and technology. We've got to recommit that being preeminent in science and technology is absolutely critical to our economic future and therefore key to national security.
You're listening to the Innovators Radio Show and podcast on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM with Tom DiOro and Pete Newell.
We want to tell you about KidMob, which is a nonprofit mobile kid integrated design firm guided by a diverse and talented team of designers, architects, contractors, and engineers. KidMob works for the young people using project-based learning to address school and community needs. This is done through a variety of workshops, consulting, co-creation of curriculum, and much more. For additional information or to donate, visit kidmob.org. That's KIDMOB.org.
We're talking today with Mike Brown, the Director of the Defense Innovation Unit, an organization within the U.S. Department of Defense. For more information, please visit Mike's LinkedIn page at Michael A. Brown, CEO, or visit diu.mil. I'm going to take you back up on that thread, because I think, you know, I started, I don't know how many third offset strategy working groups I've sat in since 2012, but it's probably in the half dozen range. And I think my argument the entire time was it's less about the technology than it is about the sociology of the speed of update the tech. So back to the marathon thing, and say that the idea of long-term technological dominance is a farce. And it really is the speed at which you recognize you're losing it and your ability to replace that with something else. As part of the marathon analogy is sometimes you're behind, sometimes you're ahead. It's okay to be behind if you know that you can catch up and pass somebody when you need to. It's not okay to run out of gas when you most need it. And I think that goes back to the analogy of where we as a population are today, not recognizing that the Chinese have been hitting the Shu Gu and Kool-Aid stops every mile, and there's plenty of gas in the tank, and we may be not quite doing so well.
Yeah, we've been preeminent in science, technology, innovation so long as a country, we don't even know what it's like not to be.
Yeah.
So we don't even know we're in the race. So no way you're going to win the race if you don't even know you're in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow, that word preeminence, very interesting in how to do that. And Pete, back to your... you talked about the sociology about it. In effect, I don't mean this in a real dark way, but in effect, you're looking for kind of the soul of Americans, what makes us Americans. Am I off base in saying that or no? And I don't mean like, you know, take your soul and it's mine kind of thing, but it's like you're looking for that essence of who and what you are collectively to pass you up. Because that's what's going to pass you up, whether they have that soul or we have, whoever has a soul, doesn't matter what country. If you have that essence to you, you can always, you'll be preeminent, at least, you know.
Well, I think a couple of dimensions of that I would touch on, Tom. One is we very much believe in our values in this country, and we want to make sure that those are featured in the world. They're an example to look up to, and those are freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, freedom of the press. Those are existential threats to the Chinese Communist Party. They will do anything to avoid having their people be able to enjoy those freedoms, because that's dangerous to the regime. So I think if they think about history, they're much more worried about what happened in the French Revolution than they are about...
I think their internal concerns outweigh...
Yeah, an external threat. So yeah. I think for Americans, it's really about our system and the values and being an example of those, being shown to the world as being still relevant and ones that we can continue to invest in. And then second, it's about investing in ourselves, the things that truly made America great, where this belief in the benefits of capitalism, and we could talk about where that's not working for all people in this country, but it certainly brought a lot of benefit, and our ability to invest in ourselves through promoting science and technology and improving society. And certainly the challenge that we faced with the Soviet Union, you know, kind of the epitome of being the space race, really prompted us to do a number of things that I think we would benefit if we repeated. Those being federal funding of R&D, because that's the long-term R&D that allows for breakthroughs that then so many companies in our innovative society take advantage of to build successful companies. And we're talking about, yes, the internet, GPS, miniaturization of electronics. Ironically, all those things were led by government, led by defense. Now we're in a different world in terms of commercial leading those, and that's the reason for Defense Innovation Unit. But going back to invest in federally funded R&D, I think is going to be important to achieve what we want to achieve for the next century. STEM education, the resurgence in engineering and STEM fields that we saw in the 1960s, that was celebrated. And kind of where is that spirit today? Many of the folks studying STEM fields today are foreign nationals, South Asia, Chinese. 25% of the STEM graduate students in this country, pursuing master's degrees and PhDs, are Chinese foreign nationals. So we have the worst of both worlds. We allocate a big percentage of our 25% of a world-class good for us, which is graduate education, to foreign Chinese. Great if we convince them to stay and be part of our economy. Not great if we then send them home because there's no green card and no way for them to become U.S. citizens. And then the other I'd point to is moonshots. President Kennedy used, you know, his power as president to inspire a generation, that vision of let's get a man to the moon and all of the, you know, science and development that led to, which we're still benefiting from that investment. Where's that investment today? So we're missing some of those key ingredients, I think. And I'd love to see the U.S. get galvanized as that's important. Let's make that what we're about again so that we can have unparalleled economic prosperity for the next 25 or 50 years.
I want to come back to that. So you are starting your second year as the DIU director and really no previous DOD background.
Right.
So first year, how'd it go? I mean, how's the learning curve?
There's a big learning curve. I learned all about color of money, and some of the constraints to our system. And the constraints I see, of course, the Defense Department is so big, it's difficult to get it moving in the same direction. The work with Congress, which is the nature of our system, means that there's not the quick movement in terms of planning and budget flexibility that you'd like to see if you've lived your world in fast-paced technology. But having said that, it's probably the most exciting job I've ever had. I'm thrilled with the ability to drive some impact. And I think it was a very good first year. We focused very much on how to work on projects that we call transformative. And this really came from my interview and subsequent meetings with Secretary Mattis. His counsel to me was that Defense Innovation Unit is a small organization, which it is within the Defense Department. We have roughly 100 people and a budget of this year $70 million out of the $738 billion. So some people would say budget dust. So when you're that small, his counsel to me, which I took to heart, was you really have to think about what are you going to do that creates big impact. So for us, that was what projects we do. We have to think about projects that go across the services, deliver a capability that might have been there before. What can you do that's transformative? And then the other thing that we've worked on this past year is how do we expand our capacity? Because in addition to working on important projects, if we can expand our capacity, so the first thing that we went to work on was getting our own contracting capability, which gave us the freedom to do our own contracts and move at a faster pace than when we had to work with other parts of the Defense Department to get that done. And then we added some key people in positions, and we started to measure ourselves on speed. How fast could we start to work with a company, solve a problem, and get them on contract? Our goal there is 60 days, which is lightning fast for the Defense Department.
How much of the, in terms of difficulty with DIU, because I've had the opportunity to, once I've done this job, but you know, watch DIU get launched the first time and then watch all the time that yours is, how much time do you spend myth-busting and others, getting people to really understand what DIU should do and does do, and getting the metrics set right versus what some of the expectations coming from different places in the country might be, of their perception to what you ought to be. Mm-hmm. So you get caught in the middle of a firefight sometimes.
I think that's an iterative process. So we are still very much educating as to what is DIU's mission. And most people have never heard of Defense Innovation Unit. Yeah. Our hope is that more investors and entrepreneurs may have heard of Defense Innovation Unit. That's really our audience, because one of the concepts that you know, Pete's in the National Defense Strategy is national security innovation base. That's not well defined in the strategy, but I think the concept is basically, how does the Defense Department take advantage of everything in the American economy to serve the warfighters, the soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, as opposed to always relying on the same defense contractors who do a wonderful job at what they do, but we shouldn't expect them to be able to do everything. Govini just did a study that said 60% of the Defense Department budget from FY 15 to 19, so over 5 years, the previous 5-year period, 60% of the spending was with the same 10 defense contractors, so a top 10. So that's an awful lot of budget to be relying on the 10 companies. And with all due respect to what they do, very few companies can build an F-35. But when you're talking about artificial intelligence, access to the leading cyber technology, what we can do to make ourselves as humans more effective, technologies that support the commercialization of space, autonomy or small drones, these are the areas where the Defense Innovation Unit is active, because those technologies are being driven by the commercial world, not just military R&D. And another interesting statistic, in 1960, a third of global R&D was driven by the U.S. Defense Department. That means what DOD was spending in R&D plus defense contractors. That one third is now 3.7%. This is what Ash Carter realized when he set up Defense Innovation Unit. In order for the military to have the best, we have to reach out to the commercial sector. And what better place to reach out than here in Silicon Valley? So his idea was, let's place DIU where that innovation is happening. So he set up our offices in Silicon Valley, Boston, Austin. And of course, we have some folks at the Pentagon. But the idea was, let's not drink the Kool-Aid all within the Beltway and within the Pentagon walls. Get outside and see what's happening in these areas, and how can we bring what's happening in these fields back to the military? And to do that, we got to break down the barriers, because the Defense Department is not the easiest customer. So our job at DIU is to see what are the obstacles and how do we break them down, and how do we make sure that these innovative companies will think about working with us as opposed to running from us, saying, you may be a buyer, but you're so tough to work with, I don't even want to think about working with DOD. So, and I think we're seeing some success in that.
So how much of that is spent? One is convincing companies that DOD can be a good customer. The other is teaching DOD how to be a good customer for a set of companies in an environment that don't share the same business model. And I think my argument for years has been, it's not that Silicon Valley or the tech world is anti-DOD, despite what people say about Google and other folks. The business models aren't in sync with each other.
How are you leveraging
what you know?
I was just going to say, you hit the nail on the head, because a lot of folks who will visit DIU or the Valley are concerned about the cultural divide, and we certainly could talk about that. But there's much less angst around small companies wanting to work with the Defense Department than there is, how do I make sure that it's worth my while? Because if you can show investors or entrepreneurs that, yes, there is a business opportunity and one that fits in their business model, then you get a lot of traction. And that's what we try and do. So to answer your question, we spend time on both. We have to spend time making sure we can curate a problem that the Defense Department has. Curate means if it's classified, how do we talk in terms that are unclassified? Or if the Defense Department famously specifies to the nth degree what the solution is, rather than just talking about the problem, this is something you know a lot about, Pete. We have to say, no, let's just ask the commercial market what they could do to solve this problem. We don't tell the commercial market how to do it. If you're designing an aircraft carrier, maybe that is the way you do it. But if you're looking for what's the latest thinking in artificial intelligence, probably better to assume we're not the smartest and we should turn to what the commercial world is doing. So that's the whole philosophy. How do we let the creativity of commercial companies influence our thinking at the Defense Department? And then how can we be easy enough to work with? Speed is a part of this. How can we make sure that money gets delivered in their hands? In our case, through prototype contracts that can immediately transition to production without recompeting is one of the key elements. So how do we make that happen? How do we do that repeatedly? How do we make sure that more companies experience that and continue then to rinse and repeat, tell the story again to a broader set of, of folks, expand our capacity so that more companies can be successful working with the Defense Department? That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, this is the Innovators Radio Show and podcast on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM with Tom Dio and Pete Newell. We're talking today with Mike Brown, Director of the Defense Innovation Unit, an organization within the U.S. Department of Defense. For more information, feel free to visit the LinkedIn profile of Michael at Michael A. Brown, CEO. Again, that's the LinkedIn profile of Michael A. Brown, CEO.
Doctors Without Borders delivers emergency medical aid worldwide to people affected by armed conflict, epidemics, natural and man-made disasters, or a shortage of healthcare services. Since its founding in 1971, dedicated medical teams have treated over 100 million patients. Doctors Without Borders relies on private contributors to maintain its ability to operate independently and respond where needed at a moment's notice. To learn more, please visit doctorswithoutborders.org. The U.S. Commission of Fine Arts was established by Congress the 17th of May in 1910. It is an independent federal agency charged with giving expert advice to the President, the Congress, and the Federal and District of Columbia governments on matters of design and aesthetics as they affect the federal interest and preserve the dignity of the nation's capital. The commission is composed of 7 presidentially appointed experts in relevant disciplines, including art, architecture, landscape architecture, and urban design. Through its unique work as the only federal commission dedicated to design, review, and aesthetic excellence, the Commission of Fine Arts serves the American people, international visitors, and those who live and work in the nation's capital, contributing to the beauty and dignity of this international symbol of American democracy.
So, in the interest of not running this for 2 hours, and I get more questions now than I started with. Let's talk about people for a minute.
Okay.
First, there's the concept of DIU and largely, primarily, dot mil military people. How difficult is it to find people who fit well in I don't want to say an incubator like DIU, but you're pulling from the military services who generally haven't been known for having a background in creating people that do this. So one is, from a culture standpoint at DIU, what are you doing to kind of solidify what the professional MacGyver is? And I get that my best explanation of it. And then in terms of scale, what does that look like over, you know, the next several years for DIU versus how you try and scale the capacity out to other places? And you guys have done some great things about, particularly Thank with you. Other transaction agreements that have helped. So now, where are you with both those?
So I think what we're trying to do is build an organization that has both military as well as civilians, because civilians provide the continuity, as you well know. Active duty military are typically on a three-year assignment, and then they rotate out. Yeah. You'd never build an organization that way from scratch. You'd like to have the continuity history, but that's the way. We have to work with the military as it is. We're not trying to change that aspect. So we're combining active duty military, civilians, and then reservists, which are a great source of talent because their day job might be something in one of these technologies that can really help us, or a contact base that really helps us in the innovation hub. So it's really mixing those three. With the a civilian population, we like to find folks who have some military experience. I'm the exception because I don't have the military experience.
Getting it the hard way.
That's why I said it's the most interesting job I've probably ever had. But most of our civilians have had military experience. They have been active duty in their career. And then with active duty, we're looking for a special type of person. We're looking for that person who is not living for what the next command is. They have a tremendous amount of initiative and curiosity on their own, and we're fostering that. We're trying to, like many tech companies, build a meritocracy. So we're doing the most we can to eliminate rank. I found you never can do that with military folks, but we're trying to emphasize through things like having people wear civilian clothes rather than their uniform during the day, to the extent possible, calling everyone sir in the office. We're all on a first name basis, trying to emphasize the casual, collaborative nature to draw out people's creativity rather than their complicity with the command structure. And I say that's working, and I'm always striving to do better in that area because there's tremendous initiative and creativity in our active duty military, but for the reasons of how the military works when you're in a combat situation, that's just drilled out of people. But it's there to a large extent in military folks, or in the type of folks that we're trying to attract. So we're looking for people who basically bring an entrepreneurial spirit. Now, we're not developing technology at DIU. We're scouting for that and trying to encourage those companies. So largely what we do is a strategic sourcing function. It's a project management role. So we're looking for people who thrive in that kind of environment.
Who can talk to humans and work with people from multiple different backgrounds and things like that.
Yes, that's right. And for the right person, they find this a tremendously liberating, inspiring experience. And we want to tap into that and make sure that they're rewarded for that, for their time at DIU.
You know, I think my experience, and I give you from as a former battlefield commander, is while there's an expectation that everything's rigid in the Army, there's this horrible dichotomy. One is they say, yes, and you're commanding large formations of people that are shooting guns that tend to kill people, and you want them to follow lots of rules and things, but you also realize you're inserting them in situations where they were never trained to be, they weren't equipped, and you're asking them to make it up as they go along, based on some type of discipline and common language amongst them that they, quite frankly, it's crazy, but we ask people to do things in combat on a routine basis that threatens their lives, that when we bring them back to the United States and put them on a base, you say, oh, don't touch that. You might spend some money, you might break something, don't do that. And I actually answered something the other day. Somebody said, you know, I don't understand why we're not doing more to capture the innate ingenuity that's in this massive force and pull it forward. And I think there's a smattering of that being done.
Right.
I think that, you know, my hopes is, you know, the military folks that leave DIU go back to units and say, that's interesting, but about 70% of what you were doing at DIU, I can do my own here, which eventually allows DIU to work on much harder things.
I think that's right. We would hope to be creating evangelists, and I've been gratified when folks are leaving DIU, they say, this was the best assignment in the military I've had, and I want to go out and do this kind of work wherever I'm going. Well, that's exactly what we should be doing.
Yeah. So coming into year two, priorities for you, for DIU, what do you want to accomplish?
So we've expanded the number of transformative projects from 5 to 10. I'll come back and give you an example of one of those. And we're still expanding what our capacity can be. So we have our own contracting authority, but now we're expanding the number of people that are doing that. So we want to build that capacity out. We're doing things like exploring what we can do to stimulate the growth of dual-use hardware businesses, because we've seen that while there's a tremendous financial support for software ideas here in Silicon Valley, there's much less support for hardware. And frankly, easy for entrepreneurs to get that money from China. That's not good for the United States. So that's an area that we're focused on. We are expanding the network of universities that we're working with. As you know, Pete, we've worked with your company on some course materials that we all call Hacking for Defense. And that's a way for the Defense Department to get answers to real problems that they have. So there's a curation process there. And then students are working together, folks that have military experience, folks with no military experience, to say, okay, how would we solve that? And in some cases, that's developed a minimum viable product. And in a few cases, it's developed a startup company to go work on these. So that we're expanding now from about 20 universities to about 40 to make that something that's more common.
From the finance side, I'm going to misquote Trey Stevens here in a minute, but the discussion on the positioning of DOD venture capital versus venture capital and who fits where and how in terms of growing this. And I know that you've got some definitive ideas on where the gaps are and what DOD should be doing. And there are lots of other ideas out there. Can you talk for just a minute about what the problem is you see from the DIU side, and then where you think you could be better placed or better used to help solve that?
Sure. So if we talk about software areas, artificial intelligence or cyber, there's plenty of activity in the startup world, or there's plenty of money to support new ideas. So there, our role is just, how do we access that? How do we break down the barriers for young companies to want to work with DOD? We're all over that. In the hardware area, it's a little different. We'd actually like to see more vendors out there. When we talk about the small drone space, many of us who know that space know that 75% of the world's market share is held by a single Chinese company, DJI. That's not good for the US or our allies. So in spaces like this, another would be lithium ion battery production, where the Chinese completely dominate what's happening in the world. They field twice as many electric cars as we do, and they have the idea to vertically integrate all the way back to lithium mines. So in these hardware-oriented technologies, we need to think about what is important for our economic and national security, and how do we stimulate other vendors? And the problem is not new ideas. There's plenty of new ideas coming from the U.S., entrepreneurs coming out of our national labs, but the problem is money to support that. And most financial investors, venture capitalists, private equity, they've smartly seen software as much more profitable. I can get a return faster and easier. I don't have capital equipment and inventory to worry about. I know that firsthand from my experience in a hardware company. So we've not made it easy for those type of companies to get financial support and then to flourish, get the capital they need to do manufacturing startup and support a big customer like DOD. But I think we should be thinking about, what can we do? We formulated one idea at DIU, which we call National Security Innovation Capital. It was the idea to start a fund exclusively for dual-use hardware companies that was a catalyst for private investment, not to replace private investment. We want to encourage the private sector to come in. But if we could de-risk that idea of a hardware investment by DOD showing its hand as a big customer, the market signaling, and then putting our money where our mouth is, maybe providing some non-dilutive capital to get the flywheel going, we think we could attract a set of investors, maybe contrarian to some of the well-known venture capitalists, but ones who think there could be money made in areas that would be important to defense or hardware. Yeah. So those are some of the ideas that we've had.
So if I articulated that, because I kind of sit in the middle, I think if you use national security innovation capital in your contracting capacity to write contracts to hardware companies that simply to help them, one is figure out the R&D of building something and then figuring out the delivery channel by which they'd actually sell it, then you've probably solved the two biggest things that cause companies to go out of business. Because my take on it is that companies, particularly in that realm, burn through equity in order to do R&D and do channel discovery. And they reach a point where they're just not investable entities anymore.
That's right.
From a venture capital standpoint.
That's right.
So your assertion.
They need a little bit of help to finish developing technology typically.
Yeah.
That maybe you don't have in a software.
To write them a contract to do something that may not be consumed by DOD, but it will get them over that hump in the time frame that may answer that problem. Is that the sense?
Yeah, and at least it's in an area which we would have identified up front is important to the military. So advanced materials or batteries, power systems, small drone components, some of these areas that we have not been investing in recently.
We're talking today with Mike Brown, Director of Defense of the Defense Innovation Unit, an organization within the U.S. Department of Defense. For more information, feel free to visit Mike's LinkedIn profile at Michael A. Brown, CEO. Again, it's Michael A. Brown, CEO.
Since 1985, Project Open Hand has provided home-delivered meals, groceries, and nutritional counseling to critically ill neighbors and seniors in San Francisco and Alameda counties. Their slogan is Meals with Love, and they invite you to become a member of the Project Open Hand family by volunteering or supporting their efforts to deliver 2,500 meals and 200 bags of groceries per day. To find out more, visit openhand.org. That's openhand, all one word, .org.
Yeah, just want to talk about something specific that we've worked on in this category of a transformative project. So we were presented with the question about how could we improve predictive maintenance in the department? And this is something that AI companies have been working with commercial airlines now for a couple of years. The idea being, if you're working with expensive capital equipment, probably should treat that differently than we do with our cars, where you have a maintenance schedule and at 15,000 miles, these things are going to be changed whether they need it or not. Well, with really expensive equipment like an airplane, we should really have more data about when is that part going to fail. And that part failure might be sensitive to the operating conditions, whether it was in flying through, you know, sandstorms or very humid environments or dry, cold environments, et cetera. That might affect when parts fail. So we went to a vendor who was already doing business with commercial airlines, in this case, Southwest and Delta, who was not thinking about the Defense Department, but had built a very successful commercial business, and said, would you consider working with DOD? Let's prototype what you're doing for the U.S. Air Force. And the first answer was, I don't think so. That sounds like it's going to be pretty hard. But after working for a while with this company, we set up a small prototype with a small, pretty small fleet of aircraft. It was the E-3 Sentry aircraft. So not a big number. And we showed that using 7 years' worth of data on that aircraft, if we just gave this vendor, who turned out to be C3AI, 5 years of data, they could predict what was going to happen with the next 2 years of data. And if we used this algorithm, we could save 28 to 32% of the unscheduled maintenance. So this is a huge problem.
It's massively expensive.
Right. I think Will Roper, who's the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Acquisition, has said the Air Force spends on the order of 70% of its budget on maintenance of aircraft, not buying new aircraft. So if we could have an impact on that within the Air Force, you'd be saving billions of dollars. And in this era where we're going to need, you know, every dollar we can, as there's not going to be lots more money coming from taxpayers, we need to live with the defense budget we have. This is going to be critically important. So we then next prototyped that across 300 F-16s. And the Air Force is seeing the same kind of results that we saw on the E-3. And then let's work with the Navy. Why can't this be applied to ships and all the parts of the ships? And then the Army is interested now with helicopters. So now we have a production contract with this vendor, C3, which will allow them to start serving all of these branches of the armed services because, you know, no surprise to any of us, predictive maintenance is something that applies to anything that moves within the Department of Defense. This is what we mean when we say a transformative project, something that has big impact and goes across all the services. Because the one thing that makes the Defense Innovation Unit unique among all the groups within defense who are working on innovation is we're the only group that works across DoD, not specifically assigned to one of the services or one agency, and exclusively focused on commercial technology and how do we bring that to the department. So I'd say many groups within DoD are thinking about innovation. Many are certainly figuring out how to work with new technology, but our unique role is how do we go across, how do we have bigger impact, and what do we do that brings in commercial technology to the military? So I've often thought the name is a misnomer. It should be the Defense Commercial Technology Unit.
Commercial Soldier's Office.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself serving as an ombudsman to all those other NASA and innovation things? Because you are looking across to all of them and looking for opportunities to, you know, with Naval X or AFWorks and say, you know, I just saw you do the same thing you did, and that's of interest to us, and it's got a little bit of hurting.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. We don't have a mandate to be the organizer within DoD. No. One thing that I've seen that...
But you have the freedom to maneuver.
You're very familiar with is the department often gets multiple activities going, some of which have some very, very similar missions, and that can be a useful thing at times. One thing we are doing to pick up on some work you did with Steve Blank, which was get a conference together of different folks working in the same space, is we're now picking that up at your request, which I think was a smart idea. Yeah, Steve Blank's request to organize a government conference for the DoD and the intelligence community to pull together these groups that are working on innovation, moving things at a more rapid pace, and figure out what can we learn from each other. Do we know who each other are? What can we learn from each other? How can we amplify each other's messages?
Like an inventory.
Yes.
Somebody actually inventory all of them. Having spent a year doing this now, what if anything, have you learned that you would consider taking back to semantic or to quantum, or even if you go back a couple of years? Is there anything you've learned in this process you would take back to a commercial company and say, if I were to do this again, I would do this differently?
I think this has given me an appreciation of how important the government is in shaping policy that can really affect not only industries, but the trajectory of our economy. So when we talked about what we need to do in the U.S. to be more prosperous economically and have more greater confidence in our national security, that's something that would carry with me versus before, I think, being tunnel focused on how do I increase market share for the company I'm working for. There are bigger issues that we need to solve, and the business community needs to be a part of that. We really need, in thinking about competition on the global stage for the next 10 or 20 years, to be thinking about how do we bring government, business, and academia's strengths back together again. So ironic that we'd even be saying this in the heart of where that concept really took root in the 60s and 70s, here on the Stanford campus, here in Silicon Valley. But we need to do that again. There are tremendous benefits we get by collaborating and developing breakthrough technologies, just like we did with the moonshot.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating when you get the history of Silicon Valley and you realize that Silicon Valley was built on defense tech.
That's right.
And how quickly we'll
forget. We seem to have forgotten that, don't we? Yeah.
No, and then I only had to spend a couple of moments in the room with Bill Perry before he was on a roll. And, you know, former SecDef, who was responsible for the second offset, the GPS and smart technology, and to really get a grip on. And, you know, those guys, literally in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that built Silicon Valley, you know, they're getting up there in the years. But when you look across what they created and say, wow, you know,
pretty impressive.
Look at how far away we've moved from it from a, let's say, a historical context. People have forgotten their roots.
And some things have changed. We're now in an era where a lot of the new technology is adopted first in the commercial sector. So the early days of Silicon Valley, it was government sponsored and then adopted by government first, then later rolls out through maybe some different use cases and companies to the commercial sector. But now we're seeing a lot of these technologies, it's commercial first, and we need to be taking advantage of that in DoD, certainly not fighting that, not thinking we're gonna reverse the clock on that. We need to recognize what technologies does DoD need to lead in hypersonics, directed energy, but many technologies where the commercial sector is ahead, is spending more money, is developing things at a much faster rate than we could if it were within the military. And how do we take advantage of that? And it goes back to what you said, Pete, really the advantage to the U.S. needs to be our agility. So how much less that we think about what technology we have that no one has access to, but how do we develop a culture where, yes, we're seeing those technologies, we're adopting them, and we're including them in our doctrine within the military, which really is how do we use the new technology at a much faster rate than any adversaries. That will make sure we're ahead if we can do that.
You just realized that probably a whole nother conversation around, I'm going to call it company building, but you realize that the U.S. government invests, you know, billions of dollars in basic research in universities and other places, but can't take its technology back unless a company builds it and sells it. So the whole concept of company building in order to create capacity means you have two routes. Either it goes out to a startup or an established company that does something, or it goes to a defense firm. And those are the only two paths we have. And traditionally, it's all gone to defense prime. But, you know, the historical context of, you know, September 1920, the first tank hit the battlefield. And we still had horse cavalry out there. The folks that were selling horses and selling feed and doing horseshoes are not the folks who end up building tanks. And if we're in one of those tectonic shifts, the question then becomes, who are the rising defense primes, or how do our current defense primes have to change in order to adapt to that? I get lost on the thought pattern. But
well, I think you're exactly right. And much less a point in time when there's a shift, as we're in a continuous shift with new technologies coming on the scene.
Shift
exactly. And faster, probably adoption needs to happen than ever before. So we need to examine. I often think many things at the Pentagon could be improved if every process had a clock on it. We've constrained our military to be focused on accountability for every taxpayer dollar and ensuring there's no fraud, and therefore the systems and processes move like molasses. We're still using the budgeting process that Robert McNamara put in place to a large extent. That doesn't work if we're trying to move at much faster speeds and if agility is what is going to win the day. So we have to rethink that to decide how do we move much faster where that's the premium, that's what's being rewarded.
Before we close, public service announcement. If I'm a military member interested in joining DIU, where do I go?
Please write me, and my email is michael@diu.mil. We're always looking for great talent to join DIU.
If I'm a company with tech interested in potentially finding a defense problem.
Same email.
Michael.
Please, at diu.mil. Yeah, please write me and we'll get you routed to the right person. That doesn't mean our job, I should be clear for listeners, that our job isn't to find cool tech and figure out a home for it. We start with what are the defense problems, but we sure want to make sure we're aware of what you're doing and get you paired up if there's an opportunity to use your technology.
Okay. Awesome. Mike, thanks so much for joining
Thanks
us.
For having me. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. You've been listening to the Innovators Radio Show and Podcast. Our guest today has been Michael Brown. Michael's the director of the Defense Innovation Unit, an organization within the U.S. Department of Defense that fields leading-edge commercial capabilities to the military faster and more cost-effectively than traditional defense acquisition methods. Mike has had a long career in cybersecurity and software and is a White House Presidential Fellow. He's also been a member of the Board of Trustees and the Berklee College of Music in Boston since 2013, and previously served on the President's Advisory Council. For more information, feel free to visit Mike's LinkedIn profile at Michael A. Brown, CEO, and DIU.mil. Join us again next time when we welcome another mission-driven entrepreneur, thought leader, or game changer committed to smart ideas, innovation, and getting out of the building. I'm Tom Dior. Pete?
And I'm Pete Newell. The Innovators Radio Show and Podcast is recorded at Stanford University Studios in Stanford, California, and on location. The recording engineer is Stephen Blanton, the chief engineer Mark Lawrence, and we're all assisted by Lexi Nealon. And the executive producers and hosts of The Innovators are Tom Diorio and yours truly, Pete Newell. If you wish to contact us, our email address is interviews@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's interviews@kzsu.stanford.edu.